Deadwood Soundwave.
Hey, listener. This is an interview with Viridiana Lieberman, who worked on the HBO documentary We Are Evidence. We dropped some of the trailer around 10 or 15 minutes in, only for a minute or two, but it does include conversations that many of you may find difficult to listen to. Again, it's all from the trailer, but we wanted to give you the heads up. Enjoy the show. Welcome to the Fields of Glory podcast. This is the Sidelines Report, and joining us now is Viridiana Lieberman, a filmmaker based in Brooklyn, New York, who's edited multiple award-winning projects such as The Sentence, I Am Evidence, and Through Our Eyes Apart on HBO, and Lowndes County and the Road to Black Power on Peacock. In 2020, Lieberman was a highlighted honoree in Doc New York City's 40 Under 40 list, and her solo directorial debut, Born to Play, premiered on ESPN and ABC. I just watched it on Amazon, and it's so good.
This is going to go down as one of my favorite seasons. I know we're going to win, but that's not part of it. It's because I feel like I've got bonds that are going to last a lifetime after just 6 months with you guys. So when you're out there today, don't just want to make a play. Want to make every play. Yeah. Want to do whatever it takes to win, because every single person deserves it, but it's going to take every single one of us every single play to get it done.
An avid sports fan, Viridiana is also the author of Sports Heroines on Film, a critical study of cinematic women athletes, coaches, and owners, published by McFarland in 2015. She just completed editing Carlos, Imagine Entertainment and Sony Picture Classics feature documentary about Carlos Santana, and is supervising the edit on The Series Choir, releasing early 2024 on Disney Plus. Viridiana, we are so excited that you have taken the time to talk with us today. Welcome to the Fields of Glory podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. Also holding up my book. I've never seen it in the wild. I think people just write me about it, but I haven't. Yes, he's holding it back. And listeners, just up to the camera and my heart racing. I'm so excited.
I tell people as a teacher, one of the important parts of my job is to wave important books at people. And I think this is an important
so
book.
True.
And I'm very grateful for it. Would you just take a quick moment to introduce yourself in your own words for our audience and just tell us all a little bit about your work?
Yes, I work mainly in documentaries now. Definitely dabbling in narrative, but mainly docs. I've been editing feature docs for about a decade. Now I'm directing, which is very exciting. Born to Play was kind of the beginning of that. But going further back than that, always been passionate about women's sports, sports in general. I was an athlete, never a very good one. I always like to tell people that I tried every sport on and failed gloriously. One time my coach of my JV soccer team referred to me as a confused Mack truck. So I was desperate to be good at a sport. And the closest I ever got to, and I've literally tried them all, the closest I ever got to being semi-good was when I played rugby, which sounds like a good fit after for a confused Mack truck. And that was in grad school, so when I was almost 30. And that was very unfortunate, because although I enjoyed it, it was like I got in a car accident after every game while my, 20-something year old mates were hopping up spry, ready to go drinking. This kind of turned into purely a fan, and documentary, allows me to run out of tunnels with teams and be with teams and kind of experience that camaraderie in the best possible way. This book came because I was in grad school and I originally went there for communications. I got a bachelor's in film. I was always wanted to make movies my whole life. I was a little kid running around with the, VHS camera, and I have all those stories of high school and video production and all that. Always wanted to make movies. Oh, and then I worked in film for a while, PAing, paying my dues and all of that. And then I ended up going to grad school for communications, which made sense. Okay, film, great. And then someone said, you should go check out this class called Sex, Violence in Hollywood. And it was in a women's studies department. And it was purely about representations and analyzing film. And I was like, what? Like, we were watching everything from True Lies to Gladiator to, and it was literally just talking about the construction of the female characters and the male characters and taking the directors into account. It was everything of that sort. And I changed my life, it unlocked me. I was joking, it unplugged me from the Matrix, like everything changed. So I switched majors, went into women's studies. That was the change that made me the filmmaker I am today, because it forms everything I do, the stories I seek out, how I approach story, what I value, what I bring to a room when I'm discussing how I'm going to approach things. During that time, somebody said to me, you should write all of your papers themed. to whatever you think your thesis is going to be. So you, by the time you get there, you kind of already have all this content. I was like, well, can I write about women's sport, you know, sports and movies? And they're like, yeah, of course. And I'm like, wait a minute, what? spend my entire time just watching all my favorite movies and beyond and just like
for
writing
work.
About, like what? So, you know, so that was my thesis and I'm sure we'll get into it. That's kind of what led me to this book. And I'm excited to talk about Born to Play later, which is the direct answer to the book that I wrote. So that's kind of where I'm at. And just to make you laugh, I'll tell you that when I graduated film school, the one thing I knew I didn't want to do was make documentaries.
Ironic.
I wanted to make space epics. Yeah, I wanted to do studio films. I was like the most basic kid with the filmmaking dreams. And now it's wild because I feel like documentary, you know, you can't write this stuff. The docs that I've been a part of, and there's such a powerful, like real world magic thing to be able to say you don't have to imagine it, it exists, you know, beyond the idea of advocacy and social justice and all those things. It's a very powerful media genre that you know, has no funding and it's a struggle every time, but people are tuning in more now. So I'm proud to be a part of that community.
It's so interesting that documentary, you know, film is kind of where you ended up. Real life can often be so much more exciting than the stuff we make up. As you said, as a young filmmaker, you said you made films as a real young person. Do you have any like early movie efforts? Like what was like the earliest movie that you made? Are you willing to share with us like what you tried to do?
Oh my God, they were terrible movies.
Yeah.
I liked space epics, so I certainly tried to do some sci-fi, dress my friends in all white, and like have them have a very serious conversation over a panel of fake buttons. But I, when I was in the worst film I ever made, just for fun, was called Beauty and the Beach. I think you can guess what the plot of it was, but it was when I got to film school and we were shooting on 16mm, and it was like a torrid love story on the beach that I literally called Beauty and the Beach. I mean, I tried to make a hockey film. Like there was a couple things, but they were all just VHS messes. And I mostly just filmed my friends. You know, we did a Blair Witch ripoff. That was
nice.
Fun.
Nice.
I feel like everybody our age did, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's just we shake the camera around, like put it right in your face.
And, we went out to the woods, we shot the whole thing. And then when we came back, a friend of mine was a waitress at a diner and she was the one that had been missing. And so we like guerrilla style shot this, like, we found her, you know, and she was at the register and it's black and white. It was hilarious. I cut it together. I mean, it was not on the radar to submit anywhere. It was literally just making it for my friends, you know, it was like,
so. Yeah. Some of the best projects, I think. Sounds compelling. You touched on this just a little bit in terms of like your own research coming up. But I like to ask this question as much as I can. Why is cinema important to you? Like, why do movies matter? Who cares? Why would you do this for a living or be able to do this for a living?
I mean, beyond the wonder, right, of it and me being swept away in the escapism and the kind of magic of what imagination and all those things that anytime you watch like a hype trailer going into the Oscars or whatever, like other beyond that heart racing fun. As I get older, the more I realize, you know, how the meat is made and like how much representation matters. And I think we learn a ton from movies, even if it feels like they're otherworldly or silly or that we know we're smart enough to know it's not real. I don't think that's true. I think we're absolutely relating and learning about ourselves and others and getting ideas of how to operate through the world, you know, how to navigate. Learn about places we would never go. Said recently, and I really believe this, you know, pop culture and media, I think, are America's biggest export. I mean, I think that's literally what, you know, I was overseas. I was in France recently, and all of the music, most of the movie posters, American cinema, and I'm talking about American specifically just for this conversation, and watching films, right? Like I just watched Anatomy of a Fall and various other films from around the world that are complicated, but very educational, right? Like, I mean, the way that your mind is working to unpack legal ramifications or the way characters work, people we would never know or people that we do find ourselves within. And growing up, like there was a moment where cinema was escapism and dreaming of what could be in a future. And I had my daydreams all day, all night. And then when I was in school, it became about representation and the power of being able to re-educate people with opportunities we never imagined were possible, or, you know, access to learning places we would never get to go. And now it feels like the best medium to engage in conversations about literally anything, identity, human beings, animals, places, the earth. Oh, wait, am I allowed to swear? Sorry.
We put a coach's whistle over swears, so you're fine.
We'll whistle it.
Okay. Yeah.
Flag on the
play. No, I swear a lot. I've already been so good.
So do we. We use the whistle a lot.
Yeah. No, but like literally anything. I just think, you know, when, especially in docs now, right? I think if folks had a choice between reading a book and watching a doc, they're going to watch the doc. And I'm a reader. I love reading. And I think right now we've hit a moment where television, but, you know, and cinema, whether people imagine only it's only a market in tent poles, it's not true. I mean, I think that there's a lot of the media being made, particularly in films, have become our sole source of conversation, education, and enlightenment when done well. I think cinema is so powerful. I'm obviously biased because I've dedicated my life and my soul feels only right when I'm in a theater. I used to go to the movies once a week. I mean, just because it was required. Now I have so much going on, it's harder. But when I forget who I am, I like go to the movie theater. And when I'm sitting in there, I'm like, I mean, from every second of it, regardless of the film I'm seeing and regardless if it's good or I like it or whatever, it's the action, the communal action of watching, yeah, experience perspective.
So I noticed your editing in your film Born to Play seems different than your 30 for 30 episode Breaking Away or I Am Evidence for HBO. Are you given guardrails by ESPN and HBO when working on projects? And what type of input do producers and directors typically give you on an edit? What way could it differ from your instincts in the edit bay? I know that's a lot, so I apologize.
No, that's up front, okay. Well, I mean, one of the primary differences, obviously, I directed Born to Play and I didn't direct those other two films. But what I would say is the approach and the style of film always, you know, is specific to whatever the story is. I mean, me personally, I hope that someday in the collection of work I make that I direct, you'll kind of see a cohesive voice and a conversation happening. But as an editor, you know, I'm working with another director with their vision, even if I'm given a lot of creative liberty to be a part of it. And the network does play a role in whatever their brand is and what kind of collection and conversation they're engaging with. And then, you know, 30 for 30 is a franchise. It's a history of how those are made. Now, they're all very different, obviously, but the values placed on the story with Breaking Away, we had the challenge of kind of trying to do a lot of legal and social justice work, but still encapsulating it through a sports lens, which isn't hard when you're one of the greatest basketball players of all time.
She was fantastic.
The MVP, Maya Moore!
Well, Maya Moore, she knows how to win.
Maya Moore, a champion yet again, still has not gone back-to-back years without a title since high school.
At the height of her career, Maya Moore stunned the sports world, stepping away from basketball to fight for justice and the release of one man, Jonathan Irons.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of conversation about how much legalese or, like, you know, how far away from the court are we going to go? So with that, you know, with anything I'm working on, what I care most about is the personal perspective driven by emotion and things like that that are universal. And then the lens that's kind of placed onto it really becomes a balance of what materials we have. I mean, this sounds Captain Obvious, but what materials we have and what we have to achieve. And I Am Evidence were stories of survivors, you know, that we then had to find the best way to activate, but also respect. There was a lot of films I cut early in my career that were complicated, hard topics.
I always was told, if someone touches you, you tell, you tell, you tell.
But they're just going to go out in a week and catch them.
And right now, my name is on a box, on a shelf that has never been tested.
Really stunning news today about the number of rape cases police have never even tried to solve.
The best way to kind of make your way through that is by having people tell you their story and how, you know, and not try to zoom out and make whole statement about them without just hearing in their words. That's the magic of docs in general. So I guess what I would say about the cutting and Born to Play, though, when you see Born to Play, that's the purest version of kind of what I wanted to do with a women's sports film. One of the highest values that I wanted to place on that film was trying to make it as cinematic as possible. I basically wanted to give a cinematic treatment to these female athletes that their male counterparts have been getting for decades.
She was about 4 when she told us, when I grow up, I'm going to be a football player. His team didn't really have a quarterback. And Donnie, out of the blue, just said, have you ever seen Allison throw a ball? So she came in and she threw 2 balls
And he said, do you want to play? And that was it. So that was the beginning of her playing. Most valuable player of the year for the whole league. The most winning quarterback in the country. She's humble about it. So I'm not. Anyway, I'm proud of her. I'm really proud of her.
A long time ago in a land far, far away, in 2003, I was a rookie along with T. Brown and Sue. And it's pretty cool, like, as a grown-ass woman, to be around people that you look up to and that you want to be like and that you want to emulate. And Sue is one of those people for me. You know, I have some wishes for this game. When the final whistle blows, I want to be the first person to look Sue in the eyes and say, after 15 long years, that you are a champion.
Today is going to be our legacy, ladies.
Let's let the world know what Boston Renegades football is all about.
One of the highest values that I wanted to place on that film was trying to make it as cinematic as possible. I basically wanted to give a cinematic treatment to these female athletes that their male counterparts have been getting for decades. You know, I mean, it was like one of the reasons why women's football, although it is struggling for many reasons, and one of those is certainly path to grow talent that doesn't break, you know, with women and girls as they grow up and all of that, so that the skill and the playing field can be better. But beyond that, when you're watching a game, if you shot those games the same way they shoot men's games, like in it, you know, like sweat, running, kicking, like ball, like spirals in the air, you would feel the same excitement because they're doing plays that are epic. They're putting their bodies on the line. They're doing all the same things. And it's not a, you know, it's not a one-to-one ratio of being like, oh, can that QB throw for 60 yards? You know, it's like she threw a beautiful spiral to somebody who made an impossible catch. There were a lot of things about Born to Play that I tried to achieve. And one of the top line was like both in shooting it and the cutting of it to make it feel like a sports classic. And ideally, a majority of it not shine a light on the exceptional role that these were like women you were watching. It's treated as a story about a bunch of athletes coming together to do this thing. And with that in mind, that those obstacles would arise naturally. Like if they don't have the money, the lights get turned off. Okay. But we don't need someone to tell you, you know, those lights get turned off because we're female athletes and we don't have funding because, you know, it's like, no, we just don't have the money for the field. That's what's happening. And that when I cut that in Born to Play, it was very important to me that that letter at the end, there's a letter at the very end. It's from a fan.
To the members of the Boston Renegades, thank you very much for signing a football for my daughter, Hannah. Hannah's 8 years old, and this year was her first year playing football. She plays free safety and right tackle. And every day, literally, for the past year, she reminded me to sign her up for football because one day she hopes to be a Renegade. And every day she's been in the street practicing, throwing and catching with anybody and everyone. When I signed her up for football, Hannah had to get on a field with over 100 boys and only two other girls. She did, though, and every time she got scared or tackled and I told her she could stop, she looked at me and said she couldn't because she would never have the chance to be a Renegade. Each player, coach, and staff member, thank you for being you and for... Thank you for being you and for breaking barriers. You're inspirational, love you. It's pretty good, right? So someday Hannah will be a Renegade.
And that letter kind of reminded you, oh yeah, I just saw something really exceptional. Like I almost got used to a world where women play football and then I realized it's not. So all of the editing choices in Born to Play were so intentional, as all are, but I cut that with no networks or anybody kind of, I don't want to use the word imposing, but kind of coming in with any premeditated needs of what had come before. And when I did get notes from producers, I was so hell-bent on doing what I'd set out to do that I just didn't concede to anything. Like, there were times at the very end where they were like, if you just leaned into this or that or this or that, this film would have a better chance of going more mainstream. And I was like, no, I spent like a decade of my life doing research about representation of female athletes. The last thing I'm going to do is sacrifice the very thing I spent, you know, years writing about even if it comes to the detriment of the reach, because I just wanted those women to get to see themselves as who they are, the truth, as athletes, not female athletes, right? That's all to say, kind of bringing it all back, that yes, producers have a ton of say in some of the bones of a structure and some of the textural elements of style and approach to what their brand is or what's expectations there. And with I Am Evidence, it was a small team, but it's still HBO. You know, I mean, like they had great notes, but I Am Evidence was also Mariska Hargitay. You know, it's like we had people involved who there were many layers and facets to how that film could be effective. And everybody, you know, kind of brought those to the table. And then with the 30 for 30, DSPN, that's a storied way to tell. I love it, though. I want you to know that film originally was supposed to be shorter. We did. It was amazing. We did I think we must have succeeded quite well in because they approved a much longer version of that. And I think that's a testament to Maya Moore, obviously. And the director, Rudy Valdez, who's phenomenal. I've worked with him on many, many things, shot that film. And he always shoots out in such an intimate way that, you know, you got to spend time with a person, not just Maya Moore, right? She was a person.
Yeah.
So that's always the goal. It's funny you asked me that question because I'm always like, notes. I have like a problem with authority. I get notes. I'm like, but I'm getting better as I get older.
I think there's three editors on this podcast right now. So that was the question I was the most interested to ask just because I kind of figured, but I wanted the audience to know because there's all of these calculations that go in. And I do want to say Born to Play, I was watching it and my kid came in and was like, I thought you don't watch the NFL anymore. And I was like, this ain't the NFL, kiddo. And like, you really couldn't tell, like the way that it was lit, the way that you cut everything together, even just the uniforms, you could not tell who was in those uniforms. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that was the idea. That's brilliant to hear. I feel like I wanted to know that there was a player on the team because she's had kids. Kids have grown up watching her play and the team play. One time they were in a restaurant and the Patriots were on the TV and he said, oh, boys play football too?
Good for them.
Amazing.
Good for them. Oh, look at them out there playing some football.
It was wonderful. When Born to Play came out, it was, you know, during COVID, summer of 2020. And my producers and I were chuckling at the idea that the only new football that anybody could watch was the film Born to Play.
I'm really grateful for your story about editing. I teach a class and I tell students that if it's your 20 million on the line and I tell you you'll reach a wider audience, are you going to turn that advice away? Yes or no? Like, it's hard to be like, let's make less.
I think it depends.
But I think it can make more money when you tell a better story. And that research is often totally misleading and baked with the wrong expectations about good storytelling. And the lights going out in Born to Play again and again doesn't say it out loud, but it says it out loud to you on the screen. And I couldn't help thinking about Rudy, how we will make this movie about this guy who does this one thing this one time. And it's like this legendary movie. And we will like turn the lights out on this stadium. And it's like, no. Why?
Yes. Yes.
Just powerful. I just really loved that image. I didn't love the imagery, but I thought as a director, as an editor, it made the point very clear. And NFL Films is legendary for how they transformed, you know, filming. It's up close. It's on the field. It's intense. It's a great film. Yeah.
That was the goal. Thank you so much. I think it's the classic thing, show, don't tell. And that is me as an editor always striving in Doc in particular to make them feel narrative and cinematic is to find it's a visual language. We don't read movies. We watch them. So like the concept of being able to make those choices in any venue, right? All the films we've kind of discussed to find those moments that can do so much work with so little. I mean, that's the dream. And when that happened, I didn't even just behind the scenes fun. I didn't know the lights were going to go off the first practice I was shooting with them. They kind of told me everything. I just was like, you know, I had to earn their trust. But once I was filming, I didn't say, okay, teach me your whole world. I just was in it. Yeah. And the first time the lights went off, I was like, oh no, like that sucks. And then it happened again. And then I was like, is this a, and they're like, yeah, they showed up at 9. And I said, you just play until they go off. Yeah. So then, you know, cut to a month later, my DP and I are literally like camped out at a different point on every, you know, it'd be like, oh my God, 8:58, go up to the top of the stage, you know, but it was a trip because it was exciting in the moment and then kind of always heartbreaking in the reflection.
It sucks.
Yeah.
Just leave the lights on. Yeah.
I mean, the guy who dug the life there was so nice, but he's
I'm
like,
sure. He's not trying to kill anyone's dreams. He's just doing his job.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I'm not meaning to brag, but in Helena, we had a minor league team and they left the lights on for like 2 hours after they were done playing. Like, it can't be that bad.
There you go. Yeah, it's crazy.
Born to Play has an absence of music in the semifinal, I noticed, but it's very present in the championship game. What typically plays into your decision when deciding to use diegetic music, incidental music, and when to use silence?
It's such a great question. And you know, that sequence in the semifinal against the DC Divas was basically how I had fantasized making the entire film. I've always had a dream of making a full verite film. And in this one, in the end of the day, there was just too much that people had to learn about their world to really, I think, be as invested as I wanted them to. So I had to kind of submit to interviews and a little more contextualizing than I had dreamed. So by the time we got to the semifinal, which was arguably the most competitive game their entire season, you know, and it was a rivalry of historic proportions in the women's game, and just wanted you to experience it. And you know, the spoiler alerts, but the championship is not as competitive. It was for a little bit, and then they just ran away with it. So I knew that to a certain degree, although I could raise the question of what will happen in the championship, it was gonna kind of be a joyride. So I wanted it to just kind of be an explosion of the heart and soul with music and everything, and just like float off into the stars with them on this incredible thing.
Folks, that's going to seal it here.
And there's your final score. The Warriors with 18, and with the victory, 42 points, your Boston Renegades.
And then I, you know, the climax of the film very much is the semifinal. And part of that is not just what happens, you know, which is unexpected, that, you know, to win by 2 points and how crazy, but it was also treating the game in the most raw sense I possibly could to show how exciting it is. Because once you kind of put the music and that's amazing. That's what I love about cinema, that you can put all of these layers of the sensory experience to elevate it to a place that we could, that the human mind is like, we can imagine things that glorious, but you get to see them go. But that semifinal to me, I wanted it to be as raw as possible, to be like, no, this is the game. Like, this is them. This is how they play it. It's loud, it's hard, it's quiet, it's confusing. It's, you know, there's like everything about it was me to try to give the most unapologetic, like raw sensibility to a sequence that then was hopefully earned, you know, everything you've seen, to be able to just let go and be with them. And it's like my favorite sequence in the whole film. It really speaks to the power of observation. I mean, obviously I cut an entire game down to the handful of minutes it is, but it's really left to you to take it in. You know, I'm not going to give you a bunch of music and like distractions and like other things to tell you how to feel. It's like, no, just feel it. I mean, I bring in music when clearly they're going to win.
But it's
really
subtle. It's real subtle music. It doesn't like, oh, yeah, with a big melody. It's like, no, it's like an event. It's really, yeah!
As a creative, I love drones and tonal landscapes, and that's where I start with all my edits, is super ambient.
This crowd's starting to get live. They can sense it.
And off to Pasquale, finds a hole up the left, gets a good block. She's still going up. She's running down the sideline, the 20, the 10, the 5, into the end zone.
All the stars for Boston getting it done tonight.
Patriots better watch out, because it looks like there's another ring coming up.
Great catch.
Bonds pulls it in.
And that's why when I, you know, the score was really about being incredibly complex, but ultimately very simple. You know, it was like, you don't want it to drive.
We play in Revere, just east of Boston. We can only afford to buy field space 2 times a week. We only have 2 hours there, and when it comes to 10 o'clock, it's over. We tried to live stream.
And what does energy sound like without kind of beating the drum and stuff? So
when you're out there today, don't just want to make a play.
want to make every play, want to do whatever it takes to win, because every single person deserves it, but it's going to take every single one of us every single play to get it done.
The Uber to my plane yesterday, the whole plane ride here, I was like, yeah, that's it, that's my teammate, we're the Renegades, come watch us play, we're gonna be here, we're gonna do this, like, check us out, like, look at us, because that's who we are, that's what this team does to me.
That sequence I love, I can't believe you highlighted it, because it's absolutely my favorite. The biggest reason I did that was because I wanted to have, you know, the glorious big kahuna fireworks spectacular of a finale with all the cinematic tools and what, you know, toys at play. But I also wanted to give a super raw, real human version of what their game is, to respect that for what it is as well.
You did a great job. When you're filming a documentary, how do you approach it in terms of what narratives you're going to follow to tell the story? Do you have them kind of worked out ahead of time, or are you discovering things as you go? Is it perhaps a mix?
It's a mix, but I would say this. I am a firm believer in discovery. Like, I get nervous when people overplan a doc. It's like a great exercise to write out a prose, like, narrative version of what you could dream your doc could be, so that you can kind of have an understanding of why you're doing what you're doing and when you're going there and what you kind of hope happens, but also what you don't. But at the end of the day, if you kind of get locked too much into what you think it's going to be, you'll miss something. You'll miss what it really is about, or if there's something that came around that perhaps should have been more of the central focus. And that has happened. I've been on docs where they began shooting it about one person, and then by the end, it's about somebody completely different. Or I've been in the edit where they've cut it with the way that they originally planned, and then we're like, I don't know, this figure is really profound and kind of speaks to all the themes in a bigger way with less. And so it's a total process of discovery. With Born to Play, I had no idea what was going to happen. And I didn't know who it was going to be about. I just started filming a bit of everybody. And the people it ended up being about were the people who wanted nothing to do with being on the dock, which is how it always works.
Yeah.
Because they were, you know, they just wanted to play the game. They're like, we don't want distractions. But, you know, then they were, of course, the ones that kind of became the most instrumental. But as an editor, my job, or so it's been, I've been very privileged to kind of work with directors in the same capacity of getting enormous creative freedom. And they just give me, you know, hundreds of hours of footage, and we find it. We find the story. And of course, there are themes. You began with themes, you raised a question, you asked it. Or if it's a retrospective, yeah, you're going to kind of know what you're doing when you have archival and all of this, if you haven't unearthed it. You know, with Loudoun County, The Road to Black Power, I was hired on that film because they had no archive. That's what they told me. We need to be inventive and try some weird things, and we were open to all ideas. And then this archival wizard of a woman came on, Lizzie McGlynn, came on and found the archive. And then I basically got to cut almost a full year. So it's all in the discovery, and I recut that film so many times. That was such a great experience and process, and realizing that you don't know what you have until you know, I mean, the joke is that you're never done. You just run out of time. That's what it is, which is true in docs. You just kind of hit a moment where somebody's like, we're out of money, or we have the film festival deadline, or whatever kind of superficial thing that they can impose to be like, you're out of time. That's kind of how docs finish. I don't think you can ever really plan what's going to happen, because there's like infinite ways to cut it and make it. But what I would say to anybody who's making one is just really enjoy, bask in, trust the process. You should have some form of direction going into it. The one thing I knew with Born to Play was that I was there to make full feeling representations of female athletes. I wanted to give it the cinematic value. I didn't care how it ended. If they were crying on the field because they lost, then that's the end too. Like, it's just a sports story, you know, whether they win or they lose. And it was irrelevant to me about the outcome. Like, I didn't care if they won. I cared about them doing it for themselves. The film was not hinged on their success. And that helped. You know, even as an editor, when I'm listening to interviews, I always have to watch everything. I'm obsessive. Because when people pull selects for me, you know, when they pull pieces that they think are the way it goes, it's mostly what's in between that makes the film great. Like, it's actually not the quote. It's not the soundbite. It's not the thing that was in the outline that they've translated into some kind of moment. It's like, no, it's like actually looking into the person's eyes and seeing when they take their breath and, you know, studying the human dynamic. The more I work in docs nowadays, there are plans. People are doing it a little more, which I think is why you're feeling a lot more formula. I mean, I think when you get into the last chance yous and the cheers and the Making a Murderers, you know, like, and I'm talking about the ones that kind of set the formula and then everybody just took it. There's kind of a plan happening. Like when they're filming, they're like, oh, good, you fit that archetype. Okay, you fit that archetype. Okay, you. And that's when you start to go, you know, like you start to go, oh boy, what are we doing here? You know, like this isn't scripted. So it shouldn't feel that way. You should just follow the story and see what happens, which is the best part of Docs.
I was gobbling up the Drive to Survive Docs, but they feel a lot like Hard Knocks. And then I watched your doc and it was like a movie about real people. And it was just very different.
Well, and those are fun. They serve a different, I think the magic of this is like they serve a different purpose. We just can't kind of blend we can't make that the standard to be met. Like we still have to meet a project where it is. And then if it kind of fits close to those genres, you'd be like, well, if you like this, you're going to like this. But ultimately, you know, every film should stand on its own.
What does a project have to contain for you to consider working on it? I noticed some themes that I think come up again and again, but I'm kind of curious where you're coming from on that.
Can you tell me the themes? Or am I putting you on the spot?
It just seems like there's a lot of social justice stuff, which I'm all about. So, I mean, everything I watched that you put up, I really, really resonated with. I mean, aside from your short films, like the stuff I watched that you edited and directed.
The doll one was so funny.
It's so long ago.
Yes, I would still love you even if you shaved your head. But please don't.
Oh, I'm not going to. It's just a hypothetical. Okay. Would you still love me if I had a doll collection?
Who didn't have a doll collection?
No, I mean like now, as an adult.
Oh, well, it's not ideal. But yeah, I'd probably still love you. Just as long as you didn't like display it in the living room or anything like
no,
that.
No, no. She wouldn't like that. Nothing. What if it was just one doll?
What?
Would you still love me if I had one very specific doll?
Yeah, that would be better than a whole collection.
Cool. Cool. What if she was, like, super realistic?
The doll?
Yeah, like, almost human, but you could tell it definitely didn't have a soul.
Hypothetical, yeah. It was just fun. Yeah. Anyways, yes.
It's so good.
I think you guys watched that. I will say that coming out of women's studies, I was most interested in advocacy-led, you know, use a film as a tool type things. I mean, there was a blend in my brain of a little kid who wanted to make the studio epics, you know, narrative, imagination, dreamscapes. And then this now women's studies major who wanted to make content that could make a difference, you know, and that was smart and that challenged viewers and that raised questions. And then those blended because now the only thing that makes me really choose a project is usually approach. I mean, it also is now. I've been very privileged to work with so many people that it is also, you know, who I'm working with because I don't want to work with a bunch of not great people. But right. I will also, you know, like that. The number one thing is like, who's on this? Yeah. But then after that, no, I think that as long as there are themes that I think are progressing conversations and narratives that we need to and are treating the subject, you know, which I hate using that word, I feel like we're scientists, like putting a microscope on people, but treating these people in these films as full-fledged people and really examining the dynamics from all angles. But I also really care about a cinematic lens. Like I really want narrative doc, you know, to feel narrative and to kind of go on a full arc and very character driven. You know, it's like there's two parts of me at play. And with the social justice stuff, it was so powerful to finish films and know that they did something, that they made a change. I mean, the sentence, they showed that in Congress, you know, and like I Am Evidence is still doing work right now for the Rape Kit backlog. You know, even Born to Play, which was ultimately almost like a palate cleanser of joy for me after a really stretch of very heavy films.
It's funny you say that because that was literally the order I watched them in. The first two of your movies that I watched was in that order because they were right there on my TV. You know, I didn't have to search very hard. And so I watched I Am Evidence and I was so bummed out. And I just took like 15 minutes and then I put Born to Play in and then I just felt much, much better. I mean, I felt great. Yeah. It's very uplifting. So I get it.
For making it too. Yeah. I think I was like desperate for, you know, something that could feel joyous and, you know, complicated still and good, but ultimately fun. But even that is a tool, right? The Women's Football Alliance have used that film. And now, you know, their championships were on ESPN3 when I met them. And now they're on ESPN2 and they play them in the National Football Hall of Fame stadium. And they have told me the film has done great work, which is always the dream. So I think the active nature of docs kind of really drives me. So when I'm looking to pick a project, there's many nuanced layers to why I'll pick it. And approach is certainly one of them, and what they're going to unpack and how, and workflow and all of that. But it's also like, is it new? Is it something fresh that can add a new perspective to something? Is it useful? Like, I'm cutting a few projects now that are varying degrees of lightness and heaviness, but they all do different work and will reach a different audience to do that work, but ultimately kind of ride this tonal spectrum and be smart and entertaining. That's what I care about. Smart and entertaining, cinematic, challenging, tonal spectrums. Like, these are the things I care about. It's never about the actual subject matter. I mean, I'll drop anything for a women's sports story, obviously. But ultimately, no, I think that the social justice stuff, I just found how empowering the process was to be a part of making those films and then watching them go out in the world and do something. I was like, wow. I don't ever sit around going, oh, I'm changing the world. I'm just a part of film that is actively striving to do that. That's really cool. So, yeah.
It just goes on and on and on after you put it down. It's like you end up with a deadline and you have to stop working on it. But that film's not done working. Like, it's got a lot of work to do. Yeah.
And years later, I'm talking about things. People bring up The Sentence the most to me because that was kind of my breakout. It did a lot of work and it won a lot of things and it did a lot. And it is still active. And when I talk about it, you know, it's still issues. I mean, the sad part about docs is that you realize things don't change very quick. You know, it's like, even if they make a difference, most of those docs are unfortunately still very relevant today and can be utilized in the same capacity. So that's the other thing, the public record of it. But I recently was in a great conversation about archive. And we were talking about how we kind of underestimate how much the films we're making now are the archive for the future. And I don't just mean like capturing stuff and we have raw footage. I mean the films themselves, because sometimes archive will die and the only preservation of it is what was cut into the film that was then digitized and moved on. And so also being archived is obviously how we shaped that film, which then becomes like dangerous about who's writing history. But it just reminds us the responsibility we have as documentarians now and hopefully for a long time to come.
We found your book, Sports Heroines on Film, when we were researching National Velvet, which you write about in the introduction. But you take up nearly every other movie with women in it that we have watched through two seasons of the show. We've talked about, or we will be watching, Bend It Like Beckham, A League of Their Own, The Mighty Ducks, National Velvet, The Cutting Edge, Any Given Sunday, and Wimbledon. We almost watched Whip It twice. this book is, it's really cool. One. Yeah, it's really cool. We say when week after week, we can pull the same book off the shelf. It's like, oh, I'll see what this book has. This says it has something to say. Here's something to say. I'll just pull this one off. What went into writing this? You said it was your master's thesis, and I'm just curious. Now you get to research movies. You're going to sit down and watch sports movies for research. Very cool. Like, what did that look like? How did you go about doing that?
It was amazing. First of all, that was my dream. You are living the dream of what I hoped for my book, which was that people would kind of revisit those films and then read chapters. And there was one class. Once they bought it, was like a book in their class, and I was like, that's it, I'm done. I did
it. Yeah. My students are going to hear about it for sure, no doubt.
I love it. As I said before, when I was in college, I started structuring all my papers to be about it. And the first one was National Velvet. Basically, the first chapter was that for the most part. And I traveled around, presented at conferences, and got into wonderful conversations. And then I just kind of branched out. Now, the coaches and owners portion of that book was because I had to make the book longer. Like, when McFarland came to me and said, we can make this a book, they were like, you're going to have to add some chapters. But it was fascinating to find that those patterns just kind of continued through a new lens of what those positions looked like. It was mind-blowing. Most of those films I had already seen because I loved women's sports films. So it was interesting to watch. I loved watching them again. Sometimes I had to watch it and then watch it again. Like, it's, I would different. Watch it and just have so much fun watching it. Yeah. And then I'd watch it again with the critical eye.
Put the hat on. Uh-huh.
Major League was ruined forever for me from the show.
Sorry. It's so funny you say that. I was just about to say, I don't feel like it ruined everything for me. You know, I'd still have, you know, like, those moments of League of Their Own I will always cherish my whole life. But I can't get over, you know, Themes of Sacrifice. Like, I'm still kind of like, It's still like you just want to watch the parts that you know are great and then just like fast forward through the moments that are kind of devaluing that setup. I just started writing all of the pages I did. I watched all the films multiple times and I'd break them down. I also had an incredible mentor, Professor Dr. Jane Caputi, who would help me, you know, translate into all of my thoughts into a streamline and challenge me to take the director into account, because there was a very much, you know, not death to the author, but a little bit, where I was kind of like, well, we're all socially constructed, including the director. So like, what difference does it make? But then when you look at a body of work like Clint Eastwood, you start to go, oh, okay, yeah, of course she could not survive. So, it, you know, there's a lot of, a ton of things where you kind of go, okay, you know, it is representative of something so much bigger, right? It's not just about him. Right. It's also what, you know, what factory he came out of when we talk about how we're all socially constructed. It was a wonderful process of making me not be able to watch some movies ever again without some disdain. But also there were movies that were great, right? Like Whip It, you know, there's things, whenever the permission conversation comes in, that sucks when that happens. But the rest of the film is doing wonderful work. Girl Fight, it's like an amazingly badass film, you know, that was so fascinating to get to watch and celebrate in a lot of ways. And it was fun to be able to celebrate aspects of a film and realize, like, you already know everything's going to count, but realize how much it really does. Well, somebody was talking about Blue Cross the other day to me, and I'm like, yeah, like, there's a ton in there that's so positive. You can't look past the fact that they're all just in bikinis running around the whole time, which could justify some entrance into being able to mainstream that concept and give them their due. But there's still these narrative choices. And it's so funny, you know, sometimes there was a moment in time when I finished the book where I felt like, this is a silly, like, I care about this, but I'm like, is this just overthinking it? And everybody's like, yeah, yeah, you're just looking for it. And then I thought, no, F it. I want to see stories that are more enlightened and like powerful and not about just swapping genders. I don't want to just see like the female version of Miracle. Like, it's like, no, I want to see full blown stories that are, you get it. But I think it was a wonderful process, and I have not watched nearly enough since. And I will say, whenever I do see something, and patterns still feel alive and well, it's like a bummer. Not always. I think it will always creep and be as accepted as the world is. And so now there's still an asterisk next to women's sports. Yeah. It's like, even when they do fight to win, like the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team, there's still this kind of exception to the rule feeling, like it's not really our standard yet. And I don't know if that'll happen in our lifetime, but yeah. I certainly hope that we'll start at the very minimum sprinkling women throughout cinema, where there's just like happens to be a chick playing that thing. You know, like the girl's friend is over and she's like, oh, I got to go to my soccer game. Like, those things matter. The tiniest of gestures matter. I think that's what ultimately my book was about. Even though it was about the top line A stories or B stories and all of that, it was just saying, like, the way we frame it, what they're saying, what choices they make, who shows up, all of that matters. And so just seeing it isn't quite enough anymore, because we're going to wonder, why are we seeing it and how does it play in the story?
Critical cultural scholars, we think that those structures, those patterns, they show up in discourse. They show up in our expectation and our judgments of the world. Like, you started this interview with, like, we learn from media, and it's these kinds of interactions, I think, that we say it's no one voice. It's a choir of voices that will all tell you the same thing. And that is a weird way of learning. And you got to learn these structures at once. You can resist them. That's the critical cultural consciousness, just to see it and be like, well, there it is again. Weird. Why do they keep doing that? But also, if you're a maker, you can flip them. And as an audience member, when you see it on its head, the ending of Bend It Like Beckham is so fascinating, because it doesn't reject a wedding story. It's going to celebrate both of these things at the same time. And
yes,
it means we have to, like, split our time, and that kind of sucks. But, you know, it's complicated. But that, it's like, it's either a rejection of the feminine wedding story or the full-on gotta go. And this movie tries to do both, and that's neat. In your book, you say that there's structural notes that you demonstrate again and again. And the one in particular is that the more unfeminine, big quotes here, unfeminine a sport is, historian will say, like, these are the sports that men play and women get to play these sports. And the more unfeminine a sport is through history, the more the women involved will be asked to kind of mediate patriarchal notions of what it means to be female. This can include structural limits on, like, force and contact and exertion, but also facing questions or speculation about their modesty, their sexual orientation, or even about their sex itself. Obviously, we've seen progress when we look at women's sports, but as we've said, this observation in particular feels really robust. I feel like every time we're still like, wow, women can do sports and it's 2023. Why is that?
I was going to say, not only that, but headline stories are always like the one woman who could play with men, which, right, I always think, yeah, is fascinating. If you ask the Renegades, the team at the Center of Born to Play, they don't want to play with men. They don't want to be in the NFL. They want their own. They just want their own league and they want to play. The only reason why women's goals to play with men, I think, ultimately arise is because it's really the only path to making a career in the sport, because men's sports, being seen. And also because we still carry this narrative that the male sport is the standard to be met and that that's the real sport. And it's just simply not true. But that's in deep.
In the book, you say that right now what happens is women get folded into male sports over time. They just like they make their way in. And that's one of the reasons this is robust. Obviously, we talk a lot about the male gaze. There's a lot to say about that. But just like as like a storytelling component, like you've been behind the scenes, you've seen the sausage come together. I can't believe people are sitting around being like, let's tell the same story every single time. Like, why does this happen? Do you have any thoughts?
I don't know. There's always going to be someone in the room trying to math it. There's always going to be someone who's dealing with the algorithm or what works or what they know and what seems familiar and what was successful for that thing over there. And there's always a norm. There's like always a, that's why whenever films come out that succeed that are so uniquely specific, we get so excited because we think maybe it just opened the door for something new. And then sometimes it does. Or it just becomes the new formula that we then kind of have to like get smothered in and fatigue so we can start again. But the slow crawl of women's sports is like mind blowing to me. A big part of that is spectator interest. The argument always goes, you know, that how are we supposed to show it if nobody's watching it? What difference does it make? Or how are we supposed to fund it if nobody's going to buy tickets? Because then we're never going to make our money back. And you're like, it's a very chicken and egg conversation. Mm-hmm. And a big part of that is, ESPN Sports Center, you know, where are the, I mean, they're trying now. But if you go to, I went to the WNBA final this year and it was bumping. Like that thing was crazy. And they did give it some media attention. Like they gave it what it's due. But it was like this little taste of, oh, this is what it's supposed to be. And a part of that is a collaboration between the sport and media. Because the athletes are going to do it. You know, it's amazing what women have to put up with, and yet they still succeed in highly skilled athletic prowess. Like, they have no money, they have no training, they usually have to have jobs. You know, they do all this crazy stuff, and yet they still,
rugby.
Yet they still, or, you know, they still hit the court and still make it happen. I just think it's such a testament to gender power dynamics, and I always have. I just think there's like things that are being protected that are archaic and holding us back. Like people always go, they're so shocked when women, the numbers of people who are watching things, you know, we have the Olympics coming up. Olympic years are always big for women's sports because everybody's tuning in and it's this like kind of magical moment. And everybody takes those numbers and they're like, this is going to be great. This is amazing. This is going to be best. And then after the Olympics pass, everybody kind of recalibrates and then it goes away. And it's like these little blips, like the Women's World Cup and all these things. I don't have some kind of grand conspiracy theory. It just feels, once again, because it is still in so many layers. And if, you know, I unpack them in the book very succinctly, but a masculine domain, and it just is. And I think everybody's kind of afraid to just give women their due and realize that it's not a competition between women and men, whether it's on the field or via, you know, what it's just about watching the sport for what it is, which is highly skilled.
More sports.
It's not, you know, more sports. It's not about like, well, she can't dunk as high or she can't, you know, like it's like dunking is dunking. The game is about strategy.
Yeah, right.
I was talking to Al, the quarterback on Renegades, and she was like, there's nothing gendered in throwing a football, you know, or like in just running to the end zone or just it. The only thing that becomes gendered is when we put it through that lens of how far or how big or what we value in the sport. We could make a huge montage of hits with women's football. There's no difference. The difference comes into how we value it. And that comes through that crazy NFL, you know, 50 millimeter cam and all that stuff they're doing now to try to make it all big. And if they did that, and if we built the narratives of the athletes themselves, right? Like when we get invested in Serena Williams, I mean, the whole world is telling us to root for Serena Williams. So where is that for all these other women, you know, in sports, or even if we're picking main figures, just like we do in men's sports, that's
right.
But where are the women?
Yeah.
And so I, you know, the why of it, I mean, you can get really radical and just constantly kind of beat the roots down of the concept that we just don't value women in many ways, in the same ways. And sports feel like this last vestige, right? Like, especially football feels like the last ruins of patriarchy. The last thing we had, our gladiators on the field with their blood and their sweat and they're big and they're hitting hard and we all like, ah! Yeah. It's the Colosseum, you know, it's like the last bastion of this concept that's holding it tight. And if women, you know, break into that, then like, what, how will men know who they are? But I think it's just so much bigger. It's because even women who are in that sport, and even women who are broadcasters, aren't always putting the devoted effort to cover women's sports. I mean, I think it's just like so deeply, deeply societal in how we are raised and how we are told what we want in life. And then it just kind of ripples out. And when you try to hone in on sports, it's such an obvious gender divide because it just is. That all of a sudden it's like, well, we're going to split the girls and the boys in hockey because the boys start getting bigger. And you're like, okay, but that doesn't mean men's hockey gets better. It just means that they split because they want to build a system.
And as a small man, I'll just say, like, it didn't do me any good. Like, I'm a small man. Yeah. And I don't know.
Well, that's the other thing I always love to say. I always say, like, some women can play men's sports just as some men can't play men's sports. Right. So it's, you know, it's the, it all goes, and there's plenty of men who can't play women's sports. Like, you know, it's like, there, it all kind of goes around. So yeah, it's such a big question. And I think all of us who are fans of women's sports and who care about women's representation are fighting the good fight. I mean, Billie Jean King, obviously, and there's all these new production companies. And I mean, who knows where we're headed, but it is wild to think we're in 2023, you know, about to be like the sci-fi sounding year. And we're still reading headlines about, you know, how the only way they can get a high attendance is by having like a special event. You know, it's like nobody's actually watching the volleyball. We just will sell out a stadium, which is great, which helps. We have not set a standard of interest amongst the people who could cheer them on.
The buy-in is the most visible. Like, you cannot avoid the NFL. I gave up the NFL a while ago, and I tell people it finds you. It like knocks your door down to be like, there's a football game on Sunday. And I'm like, I don't care. Like, you just cannot dodge it. But as far as, you know, women athletes go, you've got like Serena Williams, and recently we've got like Megan Rapinoe, and like, like there's some now, but that is a product of them literally forcing themselves to levels of exceptionalism that are so far. Like, again, Rudy didn't have to do that. He just tried hard and, you know, like.
It's so true.
But they sell that story. They push it, you know?
They push it and we anoint them that way, right? Like, there's someone, the media gods go that one. Yeah, there's so few. It feels like there's just like a Mount Rushmore of women's athletes, and not, you know, and people will be like, are those the best? And you'd be like, nope, that's all of them. Which is not true.
It's
complicated and heartbreaking, but it's good. But if people stop and watch it, they'll always love it. It's like the Renegades always say, like, if you come to a game, you're in. And I think that's the hard part, that if everybody could give it a shot, you know, like, just try.
I tell people,
what happens. It's happening with the NWSL. It's happening right now for them.
If you like sports, you should watch sports. That's to me, it's like, there's sports on. You want to watch sports? Let's watch some sports.
Well, which sport do you love? Because there's women playing it too. Yeah. Give it a shot.
There's more of it.
I had a friend who oddly got into women's softball, and he wrangled a whole crowd of folks to get like super duper into that.
Softball's it.
I think.
Love it.
Yeah. It's hard.
If you like watching pitching, watch softball. They hurl, man. Oh boy.
It's hardcore. But yeah, I think it's just about giving it time and the space and the attention, and anybody can get riled up by a good story. And so the truth is, if you publish a story about a female athlete and like what she's been through and how she got there and like what she hopes and why this game matters, now we're watching a story, right? We're not just like watching the sport just for the sport, which I think is what also helps the NFL, right? Even though it's the most, you're right, smothering of sport and sport. But it's also for those of us that have watched it and know the person on the field who just had that, you know, like, it's like what they're trying to overcome, or that's, even if it's just a stat, it's like, what is the goal that we can want? The goal within the goal within the goal. And that's the stuff that makes us. And so now we have, you know, we have more women athletes that are breaking through, but, you know, Maya Moore, you'd be amazed with how many people who don't know who Maya Moore is. So it's wild.
I want to be conscious of your time.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
I'm conscious of your time.
Hey,
I'll
well,
suck all the air out of the room.
I'm on vacation, so look out.
Well done.
Yeah, teaching has some perks, and here it is. You say that in the book that sports movies represent women better when they're from sports that women have historically played. Wimbledon is about tennis. This history is limited by a lot of these concerns that we've talked about, women being kept out of most popular sports and things like that. And so it's like,
like, on the one hand, Born to Play is such a great example because you don't want to be like, women play football. Oh my gosh. We want to make like a tokenistic story, but you can't ignore that context, right? Like that context is stifling and it is legit.
Yeah.
And you run this risk of always building the structure that you talk about where it's like defining the female athletes based on their struggles with the patriarchy. That's the story now. Or you just try to ignore it and act like it's not there. I feel like Born to Play really strikes that balance.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about like, how do you tell sports stories like that without just enabling those kinds of storytelling traps?
I think you do it by not saying it. You just show it. I still stand by that. Like it's, but you can also show things to do that work, right? One producer gave me a note of like, oh, when they go to Philly, you should cut to like all the salons, even like women getting their hair cut. And then you cut to the game and then it's like, here's the difference, you know? And I'm like, because there was, you know, there was just like, how do we, if, you know, if you want to, it was like, there was notes like that to kind of really put that asterisk there. And I think if you tell it straight in a way where you're just kind of showing their reality and having them react to that consequence, and maybe sometimes they do kind of vent or rant about it, but ultimately it's not our story to tell, it's theirs. So like if I'm making the film, I'm not going to impose the specialty quality of them. I'm just going to capture it and then hopefully put it together in a way for you to that resonates. I mean, the idea that there's like this asterisk and that it's hard to strike that balance is the exact, you know, uphill mountain Everest right now that it's climbing, because women's sports is getting more attention right now than perhaps it ever has, thanks to some figureheads and, you know, a couple of leagues really breaking through.
A lot of streaming options too.
Yeah, tons of streaming options. Those narratives we were talking about are hitting mainstreams and SportsCenter's telling you the story, but it's still such a novelty. Like it's still such a like, oh my goodness, look at her and she did this. It's just never kind of like, last night so-and-so played this game and hit, you know, 40 points, and you know, they just tell the story and they're like, yeah, it's always just like highest points for a woman and the like, I, you know, it's just, it still has that, which I guess is a way the pendulum will have to swing. Like, I think it's like, fine, make it so special that like it's constantly, you know, whatever works to just get it out more. Because I'm always saying like the best way to mainstream or normalize anything is to just have so much of it all the time that's different and runs the spectrum, so that no one thing becomes the definitive value of what that means. You know, it doesn't feel great that that's the only way it can get out there. But right now, I'm like, as long as all the sports are kind of getting a highlight, and then hopefully everybody will just kind of forget how special it is and just start showing it. You hit the nail. And with Born to Play, that was the hope. Everything you're saying is kind of what I dreamed for the film, which was like their reality does a lot of that work. I mean, I don't need to kind of open it with a women's mark. You know, it's like I don't need to do that work. You'll see it, you'll kind of go, wow, and they'll kind of say the challenges they have or what they wish they had. And implicit in that wish is what they don't, you know, and so you're able to do that work.
I've been really looking forward to asking you this question. It's so basic, but what is excitement made of? Because you have to make it. Like, movies don't just make themselves. And if a movie is exciting, that's because someone made creative choices. And I'm just so interested. We say there's narrative, affective, and production politics of movies. How do you make excitement?
I mean, I think excitement is all earned. I don't think it's like, but that, what I'm saying to that is, you can cut a sequence quick or have a heightened, overly patient slow burn. You know, you can use the score, you can hold on that shot till it makes everybody uncomfortable and then go to the thing that, you know, like there are plenty of tricks, quote unquote. But ultimately, what makes it most exciting is when someone's kind of lost in it, or, you know, in the moment, the whole world has disappeared. They're like, can't wait for that thing that you've been driving your entire story towards, or they just realize the stakes of where somebody is. It's all very narrative arc building for me. Like, it's like, you know, as an editor, there are tons of things I can do to tell you you're supposed to be excited, but we all know that there's plenty of action films we've watched. I mean, I literally fall asleep through action sequence now. Like, I'm on a plane trying to watch a movie and I'm falling asleep while they're fighting.
The John Wick movies all look the same to me. They just all look the same.
So that's clearly not it. For me, it's like, it's absolute character investment. And that works for docs too, the person, you know, where you can raise the question, but when we are driving towards that answer and we know we're close, oh my goodness. Like you're kind of sitting on the edge of your seat and you're like, oh my God, when after I find this out, I'll never be the same again. Yeah. You know, like whatever's about to happen, I don't know what's about to happen. And that is a, you know, meticulously, precisely built, well-built arc that can lead you to the moment of an answer. And to me personally, and when I make films, it's most done with character. I loved Lost. I was a Lostie when I was, you know, sci-fi, all sci-fi things. Yeah. And yeah, okay. So you're sitting there and you're kind of like, you're on the edge of your seat. You're trying to find like, what's the island? And like, what's going to happen to these people? And you're kind of going, that's great. And I still, you know, whatever. That's a whole other podcast. And we'll talk about how that ended.
But okay.
But then you go, but then you go, you know, and I had fun on that show. But it was very plot, right? Yeah. Like it was mostly plot. I didn't like, there's some people I cared about, but it was mostly just like question, answer, question, answer, like dissect the wall. Then you go to a show like Breaking Bad, where I'm on the edge of my seat for a choice someone's
yeah.
gonna make. And like, because I know the, I know what stakes are and like, who's going to be hurt because of it and like, why? And it all comes down to something that on paper feels very mundane and human and daily, or it's crazy, but it still feels very relatable in our world. Yet it had me like, you know, in a way. And that taught me so much because I used to be such a plot driven person where it was all premise and it was all twisty turny. And it was, and then I realized like nothing beats looking into someone's eyes and wondering what they're going to do. And knowing when they make that decision, all the facets of what it means. You know, I think the excitement always comes from, for me, an earned space that will always be treated differently depending on the film and what it's trying to accomplish. But it'll come deep in the film and it will, you know, and we, you know, in Born to Play, it's like there isn't some singular moment. I mean, I hope people get whipped up into a frenzy about games, but that's really me just trying to get you hyped about a sport. It's not like this definitive moment. That's all the camera magic. When I see a film that really moves me or a show or whatever that has me at the edge of the seat, it's always about the character. And sometimes there's a shot that could be so just one shot, quiet, and it could be the equivalent of like the woman hanging off the cliff and like, you know, about to die. And they're totally comparable. It just depends on what the situation is.
Better Call Saul has a scene with Lalo and Kim and Saul.
Yes.
It's like all
yeah.
three of them and they're in the apartment
yes.
and the question is, what's Lalo going to do?
You two. God. You two in your mouths, Dios mío. Now you listen.
It just yes. wrecked us. It was like the most intense
yes,
television. And I love the comparison with Lost because I want to know what the hatch is. I want to know
yes.
what the hatch, but then we learn what the hatch is. It's like, okay,
yes.
that's what the hatch is. But it's just
okay.
not the same as the choice. And
exactly.
when you build those characters and they make those choices, that's such a great note. I love that.
Exactly.
Now you listen.
Very cool.
I love Better Call Saul. Nobody saw it. You're like the third person I know who's seen it.
I think it somehow eclipsed Breaking Bad, and I don't know
yeah,
how it
succeeded. I agree with
it. Smarter. It was
yeah.
a lot
Somebody
smarter.
Did. Was it THR? Somebody said that. They put it above, and I think people were like, what? I'm like, watch it.
I think it's the people who hung with it kind of get it, and a lot of people dropped it. But do you have a favorite sports movie? This is one I'm actually fascinated by.
I'm going to be honest and say that although I critique it in my book, I really love D2, The Mighty Ducks. Like that is like, there was something about that movie, but it's fun, right? We're talking about whimsy and
yeah.
kids. Like there isn't, Girl Fight is one of the greatest women's sports movies for so many reasons. And it's elevated and it's smart. But we're talking about like popcorn candy, but I'm having a good time. It makes me feel like a kid again. I love that. I mean, Any Given Sunday was so like rough and tumble in a way, obviously, director.
You worked that into Born to Play.
Yes. Yeah.
It didn't
yeah.
go unnoticed. I'll say that. I mean, you didn't work it in, but it's in there.
Oh, that was like an alley sackle.
Yeah.
Ow.
Just
a bad.
1/2 second too slow, too fast, you don't quite catch it. The inches we need are everywhere around us.
Hell yeah.
They're in every break of the game, every minute.
No, it's in there for a reason. I mean, there's lots of work it does, but also because I just love that movie, even
yeah.
though it's toxic in so many ways. And And because it was like their Wall Street boiler room. It's like, it, you know, it's like what they do. They watch that. You know, I can't wait for you to see Benedict like Beckham. It's such a blast. Yeah. It's hard with the sports movies. That D2 is like the only one that I'm always like with friends. We joke about watching that over and over again. But I need to see some of these new ones. You know, I haven't seen Naiad. You know, there's some new films out there that I, with women's sports. I mean, not many. But I need to like retroactively watch all these. But that's such a good question that I should answer better. Because, you know, one of my favorite movies of all time, if not my favorite, is Contact, which is like a sci-fi film. But that's my favorite movie. I can't tell you what my favorite sports movie is, I think, because I love sports movies, but they're not. It's more sci-fi movies that I'm like the dreamer with, even though I love sports and want to make sports movies. And Contact has, you know, been my favorite movie since I was a kid. And I think it deals with a lot of these themes in a different way, in a different venue, with the woman at the center of it. And yeah, I was just speaking in a wedding to a friend who was getting married. And, you know, there's so many different messages in that film that we would say every day. Like, oh, there's so many good quotes that you can think of that can teach you things. And, you know, the world is what we make it and all of it, right? It's all there.
Yeah.
The vastness of space, and we have each other. But at the core of it, you have this Jodie Foster character who nobody is giving the time of day. And it's not just that nobody believes in these aliens and stuff. It's also this like flicking her off at the atmosphere, this lady, like it's, there's just so many elements to it that are fascinating, that there are some deeply seated gendered conversations in that film, in the role playing, you know, people kind of these socially constructed ideals of who they are and how they operate in the world, and obviously faith and science. And like, it's just such a smart movie. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It's weird. We're talking about women's sports and I'm telling you to watch Contact, but that's the way. But I, you know, that's, there's many, I could talk about that forever.
I'll help you connect the dots. We're not here to talk about it, but I also wrote a book on alien movies, and I wrote a chapter on Contact because is very interesting. And I study alien movies and war movies and sports movies because I'm interested in the other. Who's the other, and how do we know, and where do they come from? And what's so fascinating about Contact that links directly to our conversation today, I almost brought it up, honestly. When it comes to telling sports movies without replicating the patriarchy, there's articles, I think it's Steinke, whose article talks about the fact that Contact does an incredible job of rendering sexism on the screen. The audience is pissed at moments after moment after moment of just visceral, vivid sexism, and the movie is just watching it all go by.
Ellie.
Congratulations, David.
Glad you could come. Didn't expect to see you here.
Well, I'm still, you know, crew ops at the control center, and I suppose the fact that I discovered the message means that I have some PR value.
Of course. Ellie, I know you must think this is all very unfair. Maybe that's an understatement. What you don't know is I agree. I wish the world was a place where fair was the bottom line, where the kind of idealism you showed at the hearing was rewarded, not taken advantage of. Unfortunately, we don't live in that world.
Funny. I've always believed that the world is what we make of it.
And on the one hand, that's very powerful because women scientists are like, that is what we go through. And on the other hand, it's like, I cannot imagine myself putting up with all of that. A lot of women in this article say they see that, and it's just like, I could never do that. I would have to be Ellie to succeed in science, and she's like amazing. And so it's like, it's almost,
that's a really good point.
It's like, it's the same question with like, how do we tell the sports movie without talking about the problem?
Yes.
I think the movie Contact does a great job, but I think the article makes a really good point that a lot of women viewers are like, I could never cut it. If that's what it takes. And that's the wrong message.
That is the hard part, the exceptional person. You know, when I talk about the misfit films, I was always fascinated by that because like the signal of the misfit film was the highly capable girl on the team.
Yeah.
And it almost feels like that's where we are trapped now in pop culture. It's like, we'll give her a spot, but just her, you know, or we'll, you know, or just how much you have to overcompensate to be the absolute greatest, most extraordinary thing ever to actually gain access. But you can get there. The door's open. It's just, you have to be, you know, you're like, what does that mean? So that's a really good point.
If you compare Contact to Arrival, it feels like we've gone backwards because they're almost identical movies. And
oh boy. Yeah. It's true.
Do you have any other thoughts, Viridiana, before we wrap?
No, this was lovely. You know, I'm at such a weird point in my career where I, you know, starting to direct, but still editing and like haven't been able to find more venues to interact with women's sports stories, which is weird and disheartening. And so it's just so powerful to just talk about it and have people give it the attention you are. And watching those films, you know, and like, really, there's so few of them,
yeah,
ultimately in the larger scheme of film history.
Right.
And I just think it matters. Like, it is the amount of it. I really think the answer at the end of the day is visibility. I mean, it shouldn't be toxic and questionable and creating patterns. At some moment, it kind of feels like whatever, flood the market, like good, bad, all of it. Just flood it so much that we can't even imagine a world without women's sports. And then all of a sudden those better stories will emerge and the people will become, you know, the folklore and the legends they deserve to be and the teams that they're on. So more until there's no definitive value. And it's just all a part of our reality.
That and Better Theory. And we talked about the Misfit team for our last episode, which was the Mighty Ducks, not D2, but we did do the Mighty Ducks and we pulled that little bit out to talk about it. So
that's amazing. Thank you.
Really do appreciate it. Yeah. Viridiana Lieberman is a filmmaker based in Brooklyn, New York, who's edited multiple award-winning projects and is also the author of Sports Heroines on Film, a critical study of cinematic women athletes, coaches, and owners. Viridiana, thank you again for your patience and taking the time to talk to us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. And thanks for putting up with my brain splurges. You caught me at the end of a very long day. So
well, you know, editors can fix it all. It'll be perfect when it's edited.
Thank you very much.
In post, yeah.
But thank you guys, honestly, for making the time, but also more than anything, like reading it.
Yeah.
Caring about it, watching it, talking about it. And I don't just mean that book. I mean this topic, these themes. It's like incredible to know that you're out there and that you're doing that work. So thank you.
This has been The Sidelines Report, a production of the Fields of Glory podcast on Redwood Sound Labs. If you'd like to listen to more podcasts about the narrative, affective, and production politics of sports cinema, just look for Fields of Glory wherever you listen to your podcasts. You want to make a contribution? Go to patreon.com/Redwood Sound Labs. You can make a donation and get a whole bunch of additional content. Check it out. One more time, it's patreon.com/Redwood Sound Labs. Thanks for listening.
Would you love me?
What if we turn the guest room into a room for the doll?
That would be pretty weird.
Uh-huh.
But you know, it's not like we ever use it anyway.
Right. Yeah, exactly. What if I got the doll its own New Yorker subscription?
Why can't it just read our New Yorkers?
Because hypothetically, it might want to cut out some articles and doesn't want to wait around for us to read it, you know?
Then we're going to have twice as many New Yorkers laying around the house.
No. She'd recycle.
Redwood Soundwave.
Okay, kiddo, I lost my library of sound, so I need you to do some sound effects for me.
I don't want to do this, Dad.
Look, I'm just trying to put food on the table, but if you don't want to help...
All right.
Hear Biggs chronicle a galaxy of genre. Listen to the deconstruction of film on A Cosmic Void. Charles is a Purple Heart recipient and cinematographer. Aaron is a professor and critical cultural scholar. Together, they explore the narrative, effective, and production politics of war cinema on Real War Project. That's R-E-E-L, War Project. Finally, a podcast that's dedicated to talking about your favorite sports movies. Whether you want to hear a breakdown of the plot, arguments about who's the MVP of the film, or crit and lit about it, you'll find it all on Fields of Glory. Listen to the show that will help you have a better life with your beloved pets. It handles topics like proper food, nutrition, positive reinforcement training, and more. Certified dog behavior consultant Charlotte Peltz welcomes your pet concerns and questions in the podcast, Living with Your Dog. Zach and Matt are two horror enthusiasts of varying experience discussing horror movies through the scope of content, context, and comedy. They'll hit on the good ones and the classics, but they're really excited for the bad ones. Listen to Watch No Evil. You can find all of Redwood Sound Lab shows at Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to podcasts.